Good morning, everybody. My name is Mildred. I'm from Toronto. I'm a member of the Rocks Glen Traditional Group, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. We're so glad that you're here. And so it's my privilege as the chairperson this morning to welcome you to this meeting, but particularly to welcome you to Canada, our country, to welcome you to Toronto, and to welcome you to the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel so privileged to chair this meeting because it happens to be Canada Day. It's the birthday of our country. Thank you. We want you to have a wonderful time here, a safe time. I hope that we are all being very hospitable to you and that you feel welcome here and that we do everything for you we can. I'm just delighted that every single one of you is here. We have a great panel, and they're going to tell us all how to get rid of ego. Isn't that something? Every single one of them told me they have completed the job, and they will give us specific instructions. So we're in business, aren't we? Halos will be given out at the door as you leave. You'll notice I'm not wearing mine. You know, I'd like to take a moment also to thank the people at General Service Office who do all the so much work to make this possible. Let's give them a round of applause. I think sometimes we kind of take that for granted and think, you know, it's their job to do this. But I feel very grateful that they do that job and do it so very, very well. And I'd like to take a moment also to thank that army of volunteers from Toronto who have done so much work to do... And wherever you are, you army of volunteers, know that we appreciate you. So... And now we will have a moment of silence in gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 70 years. May we have that moment now, please. And now I'm very excited to begin the process of introducing those people who will tell us how to breach the walls of the ego. You know, I sat in my bed last night and I thought about this topic and I thought, isn't that a clever topic? Because it really makes, it made me think, because when I think of breaching the walls, I think about war, I think about battles, I think about soldiers, you know, going and fighting. And I don't know about you, but me fighting my ego is like a little innocent fighting a mad dog. The louder I bark at it, the louder it barks at me. But we have a kit of spiritual tools, don't we? And so we have three fine speakers who obviously have some experience at using that kit of tools to breach the walls of the ego. And, you know, as the book says, self-centeredness is the root of the problem. So here we go. The first person who's going to speak to us, I kept asking, where's NU? I'm just from Canada and I don't know, and I acknowledge that piece of ignorance. I found out that it is Canada's newest territory. You think that's humorous, do you? Formed in 1999, I'm only 6 years late, and it's called Nunavut. And with that, it is my great pleasure to introduce to you Earl Jay.
Thank you very much. My name is Earl, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Since I didn't see a lot of recognition to the name Nunavut, I thought I should probably give a little bit of a geography lesson so you can understand where I come from. Nunavut is the newest territory in Canada. It formed on April 1st, 1999, and it was carved off of the old Northwest Territories, which encompasses this huge landmass in Canada in the north above the 60th parallel. The provinces of Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, and Quebec. All that part in the north is the Northwest Territories. The eastern part of it, which follows a tree line starting at Manitoba, going west to the Arctic coast, is to the west side is the Northwest Territories, and everything to the east, which is about 800,000 square miles, is called Nunavut. And it is a territory that was created as part of a land claim that was negotiated by the Government of Canada with the Inuit of Northern Canada, who have been in that part of the world for 5,000 or 6,000 years. And they're a homogeneous group of about 85% of the population is Inuit. They speak the same language called Inuktitut, which is a language that is, I guess, fairly common in, and it's related ultimately to people from Asia, is where the origin of that language is from. In any event, Canada created this territory, and I moved over there 3 years ago, and I'll get to that, I guess, as part of my story. But now that you know where I'm from, there's 30,000 people that live in Nunavut. They're spread across this 800,000 square miles, 25 communities, three time zones. And the capital called Iqaluit is where I'm from, where I reside. It has 6,000 people, and it's growing very rapidly because the government is spending a lot of money there after they created the territory, putting in infrastructure such as courthouses and hospitals and those kinds of things. In any event, my struggle with alcohol started when I was 17, ended when I was 45. I'm now 58, and I think I'm probably emotionally at about 35. My wife would probably say I'm at 25. It's been a very, very interesting struggle that I've had with alcohol. I came from a large family. My father was in the heavy construction business. Worked hard, played hard, made lots of money when the money was being made, and then partied when it came time to celebrate. I went to a small university in eastern Canada and got into sports, and particularly football, and discovered alcohol for the first time in my second year at university, and it seemed to fit the pattern of work and play. Because when you're playing college-level sports, at least in Canada, I don't know, in the States, I think the coach that we had there was a little more tolerant. We used to drive her for 5 days during the week at the practices, but it was well known that on Saturday night you could go out and have a few drinks. And I got into that pattern very early and became a very, I think I was 17 when I had my first drink, and then got into this pattern of immediately drinking until I basically was plastered. I almost from the beginning did not know anything about moderate drinking. Some of it had to do with my size. For some reason, I was a very insecure, it was just the opposite of ego that we're talking about this morning. I didn't really have a lot of ego. My father had a very strong personality, and I sort of was in his shadow. I was very shy. very shy, and those combinations just seemed to fit. As soon as I took that first drink, it was like, this is the answer. Now I'm relaxed, I can talk to people, I can be comfortable, I can go to parties and make a fool of myself, but hey, I'm comfortable doing it, and it just seemed to fit. And so I got into this pattern of weekend drinking. I went to law school. I was living in New Brunswick at the time, and there was a new law school starting up, so I just sort of bounced around, and I was always able to keep myself on the road, although always finding time to have good blowouts primarily on weekends. I then, after being in law for a couple of years in New Brunswick, decided I needed a change of territory, and I applied for a job, went up north to the capital of the Northwest Territories called Yellowknife. You may remember that place. That's where all the diamonds are that they found not far from it. There's three diamond mines that are north of Yellowknife. And I went up there working for the government, and after a couple of years, an old friend of mine from college days came up. We took over a law firm. We practiced law for the next 25 years, and I became an alcoholic. It was part of the territory, I would say, the Northwest Territories, being in a frontier area at the time. It's now grown a lot, and you wouldn't find much difference between Yellowknife and Whitehorse and Iqaluit and some of the smaller towns in southern Canada. In those days, it was the last frontier, and the drinking was a lot more than you would see probably in the south. So we seemed to fit in very comfortably into that routine, and we gradually prospered over the next number of years. As we get into this theme of ego, it's like I came from not having any ego or being very unsure of myself and shy, and it's like I just seemed to stumble onto success somehow. I ended up in this law firm, and there I am. I'm making a very good living. I have a wife and I have two children, and it just seemed to be the natural pattern that, hey, I'm successful now, I can drink. Hey, and I can drink to my heart's content within certain boundaries, certain professional boundaries. So you had to make your court appearances, and you had to meet your clients in the morning with you had to cover up a little bit with 222s, but you did have certain, you had to show up. But in a lot of respects, as my drinking got worse, looking back, I think I would have been a much better lawyer if I had been sober. But I never pulled any shows. I never went into court drunk. I never showed up with clients drunk. I always managed to contain the drinking to the office or at home. And I tended to be a drinker who didn't go out to bars a lot. I tended to be a homebody. So I would start Saturday at about 3 in the afternoon, and then have a weekend party, and that went on for quite a few years. And finally, in the early 80s, two kids, the firm is doing well, we're doing well, and my wife and I seem to be fighting more. And I could never quite figure out why our relationship, which was working well up to that point, all of a sudden we seemed to be having more and more arguments. And it didn't dawn on me until years later that those arguments were coming from alcohol. That was the source of the problem. So we went through about 6 years of battling while I was in Yellowknife over drinking and alcohol, and eventually, after 6 years of fighting me, my wife finally had the fortitude, and I'm looking back, it was with the grace of God that she saw the light and decided that I had an alcohol problem and she wasn't going to stay around while it took her and the family and everybody down with it. So she reluctantly decided to uproot from Yellowknife and go down to New Brunswick where her mother and father were living. And I'm sitting in Yellowknife in the fall of 1989 saying, in a big house with two cars, saying, what happened? And it took me from 1989 until 1992 before I finally figured out what the problem was. And the problem was alcohol. I ended up following my wife to New Brunswick, promising not to drink. Went down there. Of course, I wasn't quite ready. I got hooked up with a law firm down there. It didn't work out very well. I ended up going to treatment because I was pressured into it at a treatment center in Toronto here called Bellwood. And I remember going through the 28 days. At the end of the 28 days, they had a session for the Al-Anon side. My wife came in for that week, and she watched me as I was given my graduation certificate, whatever it was, or medal, and she said, I don't think he's got it. I still see a wall there. I don't think he has cracked emotionally. And she was dead right. She knew me better than I knew myself. After the treatment, I stayed in New Brunswick for another year. I was yearning for the north. I was yearning for the old firm. I was yearning for the partying times. I wanted to get away from these restrictions that were in my life. I wanted to be able to call my own shots, as we did in the law firm, where we had a bar at the end of the hall and we could go and have a drink at the end of each day. There was no breaks on the drinking except professionally what you had to do your job. And we had a fair bit of latitude in that respect. It's amazing how you can cover up alcohol in professions or any kind of work, but certainly in the legal profession, you can carry on for long periods of time hiding the alcohol problem. So I'm back in Yellowknife for about a year before I finally hit my bottom. I went on my kids came up for the summer. My wife reluctantly, at that point we were split up. We signed a separation agreement. The kids came up for the summer. I managed to keep them together and look after them. I sort of kept my drinking in control for that period of time. I had a few friends that helped out in a couple of spots when I wanted to go off by myself and party. The kids left. I went into sort of a depression, I think, with the kids leaving. And a friend of mine who was a client owned a big lodge up north of Yellowknife, a nice fishing lodge. And it was all free. We went up on a small plane in early September. And I went on a bender that lasted 5 or 6 days, from a Thursday to the following Wednesday. And Tuesday night, I called my wife in New Brunswick, and she had already been in Al-Anon about 6 months at that time. She said, Earl, you know what you have to do. Pick up the phone and call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did. And two guys I didn't know from a hole in the wall came in and talked me down, took my booze, poured it down the sink, and then plunked me into a detox center, which was an interesting experience. And then I came down off of a six-day drunk in 48 hours with no tranquilizers, and I will never forget that 48 hours. Every time I think of taking a drink, I just think back to those 48 hours, and it really acts as a great sobering up moment. After that, I hit a roundup The first, in Yellowknife in those days, they had roundups in early September, just I think the Labor Day weekend. And I ended up with 3 days of sobriety, and I got the big book handed to me by the most sober person at the meeting, who was about 25 years sober. And I never really looked back after that. And from there, I stayed on my own for a couple of years. Talk about ego busting. At that point, I had this ego. I was a big, successful lawyer, but I lost my family. I finally faced the music. I was in financial difficulty. I went bankrupt. I moved into a small little apartment. And it was almost like the experience of going through bankruptcy. I felt like I had this load lifted off me. And I just knew. And I was sober. I was going to meetings. And I just knew that I was on the path to recovery. Stayed there for a couple of years. By myself, got involved in AA, went to meeting after meeting after meeting, got involved in a local treatment center, and then after about 4 years, my wife decided that this recovery was real and decided to take a chance on me again, came back from the Maritimes and moved back to Yellowknife, and we reunited in 1994 and have been practicing recovery, both her in Al-Anon and myself in Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. From that point forward, it was just one little step at a time. Gradually, I went back to the old firm as an associate, and after a couple of years, they decided while I was sober, maybe I was ready for a partnership again. I went back to the bank, went into the bank manager and said, here's what's happened to me. I can't say I'm never going to drink again, but I think I'm on the path to sobriety. The bank manager looked at me and said, I have a son that's in a treatment center. And immediately we had a common bond and got us to a level of communication. And he gave me a loan and was back into the law business. And then from there, I spent 5 years in the government, continuing to get involved in some very interesting cases. And then a friend of mine came in one day who was a lawyer in the government, and it came to my attention that they were looking for a lawyer who might be interested in becoming a member of the judiciary in this new territory of Nunavut. So I said, this is something that sort of terrified me in a lot of ways, but I also realized that I had to grow. Because to me, sobriety is growth. And I threw my name into the hat, and lo and behold, I was appointed to the judiciary about 3 years ago. We pulled up stakes, went from the west to the east, and we have been in the territory of Nunavut for the last 3 years. I travel extensively throughout the north, and I see the ravages of alcoholism. It's unbelievable, really. The three territories in Canada, I saw some statistics in a newspaper article recently that showed that northern Canada has about three times the rates of alcohol consumption than they do in southern Canada. And in the part of Canada that I'm in Nunavut, I think there's more binge drinking. And it seems to come from the fact that the Aboriginal people have only recently moved into the 20th century and have gone from feast and famine. So there seems to be some thinking that when you killed your seal, or your polar bear, or whatever, and you had a feast, and then you had periods of time when you weren't sure if you're going to have enough to eat, and it seems to be that that pattern is repeated when they drink. So they have the booze, and they drink it till it's gone. So we have lots of problems. The criminal courts that go through Nunavut, we travel on circuit to all the communities between 2 and 6 times a year. 85% of the docket is criminal, and I'd say 95% of it is alcohol-related. It can be very depressing at times if you want it to be depressing, but To me, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the tools and given me the base, the spiritual base, to know that there is a solution to alcoholism. And in my work, I try to, in an anonymous way, get the message out to people that there is a way. And I just hope that there's a seed that is planted here and there that someone may pick up, and that they may sober up, and then they'll sober up somebody else, and then the rippling effect that we know works so well starts to impact. But it's an incredible journey that I've been on. It's all due to my sobriety. It all comes from Alcoholics Anonymous. I was heading into an abyss. 12 years ago, Alcoholics Anonymous rescued me from that abyss. If I hadn't stopped drinking, I don't know where I would have been. And today, whatever we call it in the profession that I'm in now, judgeitis. And when I went to some of the schools that they send us to, they have judges that talk about judgeitis. And it's the ego getting to expand too big so that you think you're really above everyone else. And it's common in that profession, and I think it's also something that affects us at Alcoholics Anonymous, is the ego trying to take over, the mind is going to run and decide how everything's going to work rather than the spirit. And I know that it's a battle, and every so often I find myself getting carried away with what's going on, and I get overwhelmed at times. I get stressed at times when I'm off in some small communities, long, cold winter nights, and I have some difficult decisions to make. But what I end up doing is saying the Serenity Prayer and just saying to myself, just take it one day at a time, because that's the way it works. And that's what I've been doing. And I just can't say enough about what this program has done. It's absolutely, totally changed my life. And I'm so happy to be here. I've never spoken to this many people before, but I can tell you that it was not nearly as terrifying as my first day in court when I looked out and saw all these people looking back at me. Anyhow, I think I'm getting probably to the end of my time, and I want to welcome everyone here from other parts of the world and the United States, and I hope you have a wonderful time this weekend at this convention. Thank you very much.
Well, there you have it, how a judge gets his halo to fit. Isn't that exciting? Thank you so much for sharing your experience, strength, and hope, especially as it relates to breaching the walls of the ego. Since we began, there are quite a few people who have come into the hall, so I'd like to welcome you as well. I welcome the group as we started. You also are welcome. We welcome you to Canada. We welcome you to this meeting. We welcome you to our fine city of Toronto, and hope you all have a wonderful time. Now, we have another speaker from another part of the country, and I hope I know what NH stands for. So it's my pleasure now to introduce to you Patty R. from New Hampshire.
All right. Woo. Hey. Hi, I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Kingston 12 and 12 from Kingston, New Hampshire. And I am very grateful to be here today, sober. I told my sponsor when I got the letter on the topic that I was speaking on, that it had to do with ego, and she went, "Oh, edging God out." And I went, "Yeah, I never heard that before." And and she went, "Oh yeah." She goes, "You're perfect for that one." And And on goes how my ego gets birthed is with my sponsor and my group and God, and at the beginning it was alcohol. Alcohol beat me to the ground. I did not want to be powerless over alcohol. I once looked at my bottle of vodka in my apartment and said, there's no way liquid in a bottle could be controlling my life. There's just no way. And that was towards the end of my drinking. I was talking to myself a lot. I was by myself a lot. And I was listening to Barbara Streisand. I had a Barbara Streisand collection, and I had the headphones on, and I would drink, and I would smoke, and I would cry, because she's good for that. And that was the end of my drinking. My brother died from an alcohol-related death. He was 38. He had three children, and he was my hero. And I learned about powerlessness by his death, because I thought if anybody could stay alive if they wanted to, he would. He loved his family. But he didn't. And my carpet, or the world, just got blown away. And I had no God, because in my life, up till the time I was 27, I didn't believe in God. It was a comfort to me to not believe in God. I thought that when you just died, if you just were dead, that was a good thing. And his death kind of changed that. One thing was, when I was sitting there on my living room floor listening to Barbara Streisand, I heard, I don't know where it came from, but I heard this, do you want to go to eternity with that soul? And I was like, oh my God, now Barbara Streisand does not have those lyrics, you know? I was like, oh my God. And I got an anxiety attack, which I had plenty of, and I was very used to, so I was like, oh my God, and I was smoking, and now I'm drinking, and I'm like, no, I can't go to eternity with this soul, like I'm the walking dead, I'm in despair. I didn't have those words, but that's how I felt. And so I did not put down the cigarette, and I did not put down the drink. I just concentrated on my breathing, and I figured if I keep breathing, I can't die, and I won't go to eternity with this soul. And that's as far as my ego would let me see my problem. And I blamed everybody else, and I blamed everything else, and I had my if-onlys, and if only I had this, that, and the other thing, I'd be okay. And I ran out of if-onlys, and I ran out of excuses, and I ran out of people to point the finger to, and I was left alone, and I had a moment of truth, and that was God breaching my wall of ego, saying, maybe, just maybe, it's the alcohol. When I got this topic, I breezed through the As Bill Sees It book in the morning, and I was like, oh my God, I know I've seen Walls of Ego somewhere. And it just so happened I turned on a page, and the heading was Breach the Walls of Ego. And in the paragraphs, it had paragraphs from the 12 and 12 talking about how in step four, the sponsor sometimes has a challenge with some of their sponsees that they have to find the chink in the walls that the ego has built so that the light of reason can shine through. And I didn't have a sponsor at the time, but it was, I think God was my big sponsor. And I didn't believe in him, but he believed in me. And he put that thought in my mind that maybe, just maybe, it's the alcohol. But my ego took over, and I said, okay, I will not drink ever again. And I had said that not too many times, because I saw people go on the wagon, and they just ended up drinking again. So I was like, you wasted some good time there. You know, I'm not going to bother. So I never really tried to stop, but at the end I was trying to stop, and I was trying to stop on my own, and I was going to do it on my own. And we were on a plane, and my sister was in AA, and she was sitting beside me, and I was like, I had been on a 3-day bender, and I was hungover, and I was sick, and I got this thought, you know, maybe it's the alcohol, and I wasn't going to tell her, and I was keeping it to myself, and I was going to not drink forever. I knew about AA that they had this slogan, one day at a time, and so I was going to do it my way, and one day at a time, and on the 30th, oh, no, I am afraid of planes, and the people that came in with me will testify how afraid of planes I am. And so I was going to quit forever, and then when the plane landed, I was like, well, I'll quit for 30 days. And my motive was that if I could stop drinking for 30 days, maybe I could get drunk again. You know, because I had stopped getting drunk. My head wouldn't shut off anymore. I was drunk from the neck down. I was like the walking dead, and it wasn't pretty. So one day at a time, and on the 31st day, I was going to have a Miller Lite. And that was my motto. So I went back to work, and I scratched off the days, 1, 2, 3, and I was staying away from a drink, and I was great, and I was feeling good, and I, that was like, I saw my cousin's wife, and actually, I forgot, Ron is the reason, if you don't like what I'm saying, talk to the trustee, Ron, he threw my name in the hat. I lost my thought. oh, thank you. Okay, I was saying about Ron because he knew my cousin who just passed away, and his wife was on the street, and I saw her, and I'm feeling good, and I'm like, you know, having drink, and I said to her, I go, I haven't had a drink since the wedding. And she looked at me, and I don't know if anybody's ever had that look, you know. And she looked at me and said, that was last weekend, you know. And I said, you could hear my bubble burst. I slid down on the, you know, I stood there with a smile on my face, of course. But what was happening on the inside was I was, like, laying on the sidewalk. But I was also going for her neck because I was pissed. And that's what happens to me when I hear the truth. And it's not pretty. It's like an exorcism happens inside me that the walls of the ego get cracked. And it does everything to protect itself. And I ended up getting drunk again. And I couldn't believe that I could not do this on my own. And I was done. I ended up walking into the halls of AA. I thought for sure I had seen my sister in AA. They used to go to the beach and sit in a circle and drink coffee and smoke cigarettes. And I was like, oh, please, please. I do not want to end up like that. And, you know, and so, but I had nowhere else to go, so I came to AA, and I couldn't believe what I heard. I couldn't believe I heard people talk about how they loved alcohol and how it croaked them and how that they couldn't live with it and they couldn't live without it and that the only place to come was AA. And so I came along. And I think that that was God working in my life, too, because for me to say that I can't do it, that I can't do it on my own, that I need somebody else, that I need God, that I need people, was something that was God-inspired, because it wasn't me. And I'm so grateful for that, because I've had that feeling to this day. And I try to give back to Alcoholics Anonymous the best I can. I can never give back as much as I've been given. I had, my sister was in this Ipswich group, and she wanted me to join, and I'm like, no, I don't do groups. And she's like, come on, come into the business meeting. And I'm like, oh, man. So I sit there, and you know, they're talking about something, and all of a sudden they start taking a vote. And she's like, raise your hand. And I'm like, I can't raise my hand. I can't vote. I'm not a, you know. She's like, yeah, you belong now. And I'm like, oh, my God. And, like, I'm like, I don't know how to vote. You know, like, should we get more coffee cups or not? I don't know. And she's like, just raise your hand. So I raised my hand, and they counted me in, and I was in. I was like, you know, God knew. And The next time I went to the business meeting, they made me secretary. And it was like, somebody made it, we need a secretary. I nominate Patty. I second. Okay, yeah, yeah. Here's the paper. And I was like, oh my God. And I showed up. I was like, oh my God, Ruth, how am I going to do this? And you'll be fine, dear. You'll be fine. And I showed up the next week, and I was crying and shaking, and I was like, I can't do it. I said, Ruth, please, please, please do it one more week. Let me watch you. I want to do it perfectly. I said, I can't do it. I can't stand up in front of people and speak. And she said, sit down in front, dear. It'll be fine. And I said, oh, thank you, thank you. And she did the secretary's report. And the next week I showed up, and I stood up, and I shivered and I shaked. And I read the secretary's report, and I opened in the meeting, and I'd love to tell you that, like, thank God for the spirit of rotation, because within 6 months, I owned that meeting. Oh, that group was like, oh, my God, what did we do? And I learned about group consciousness real quick, because we had a big hall, and it was way over there, and the seats were here, and you couldn't hear, like, from the back of a hall and stuff. So one night, I said to the setup person, I'm like, you know what? We're going to put the speaker over here, and we're going to, see, I was a function manager, and I knew this stuff. And so I said, we're going to put the seats this way, then the coffee over there, the people won't be bothered, they'll hear, it'll be awesome. And I was thinking, you know, my group is going to be so proud of me. And the group members started walking in, and, like, you'd think their world had, like, collided. They're like, what is going on here? Who said this? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, boom, again, down on the floor with a smile on my face and ready to kill everybody because they did not appreciate my great efforts. And I was pulled aside and told that if I wanted to make changes, any changes to the group, that I was to bring it to a business meeting and take it before the members. And I was like, okay, now I'll do that next time. And I learned. And that's how I've learned, I guess, humility and service. I've stayed in service. I had a sponsor who... I didn't get a sponsor right away because, you know, I didn't need one. And I had my group. I was the secretary, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I also was just coming to believe. I guess this had happened before I got the sponsor was I used to go to this little step meeting in Ipswich, Massachusetts on Thursday nights, and it was in a little kindergarten room, and I loved it. It was like right where I needed to be, and I would go, and I would listen, and I would listen, and sometimes I couldn't even read the paragraph when they went around and were reading the step because I was so afraid, so I'd have to pass, then one meeting, they were on the second step, and I had it because I didn't believe in God, and I raised my hand for the first time, and I said, what is it with this God stuff? And people were like, oh, you know, and they described their higher powers, and they were talking about how God helped them. And then there was this one guy who looked at me. He raised his hand, and he had a beard, and he was very soft-spoken, and he just pointed at me, and he said, the only thing you need to know about God is that you're not. And again, boom, and like, boom, and I was so embarrassed that he was like telling the room that I thought I was God, and like they didn't know. But I'll tell you, I was flit on the floor, I had the smile on my face, I was going for his neck in my mind. But also what happened was a weight got lifted off my shoulders. And I kind of felt, I can remember it was like, And I just think it was a spiritual experience now, because it was like that sentence hit me right to my core, and it was how I came to believe was that I wasn't and there was, and the steps were going to help me find my higher power, and they did, and that was through a sponsor. And there was this wonderful woman from Salem, Mass. Now, Salem, Ipswich, Mass, little country town. Salem, Mass was like a big city to me, right? So she had come to live like around us now, and she was tough. And I was doing my thing. I had a big problem, and I was going around to people around the room, seeing what they would do, what I should do, blah, 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 grabbing all the attention. And I was bypassing her because I didn't dare talk to her. And she goes, "Hey." And I said, "Yeah." And she was like, "Come over here." And I went over to her, and she said, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "What? I'm just talking to people." She goes, "I just saw you go to like 5 people and ask them what you should do about this problem that you're having." She goes, "Who's your sponsor?" And I said, "Oh, well, I kind of use, you know, blah, blah, blah." And she was like, "Oh, no, you need to learn to trust somebody. You have my number. You call me." And I was like, "Oh, my God, you know, who does she think she is?" And I called her, and oh, my God, Ernie was awesome. The sponsors I've had in my life are just incredible. And the fourth and the fifth step, you know, really... You get a good look at yourself and your part, you know, like just my part is all I have to look at. And that keeps it simple for me. And doing a fifth step, my first one, I call it my fearful and moral inventory. I had to say to my sponsor, Ernie, and I was smoking cigarettes, and I was like, "Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God." And she's like, "Look, you know, I got to go soon, so could you get started?" You know, like, this is, I did not want to drink anymore, and I just did the best I could, and I followed the path. And for me, with the ego I had, which was kind of odd because I have, like, really low self-esteem, and I shiver, and I shake, and I have tons of fear. So when I heard in AA, egomaniac with an inferiority complex, I was like, "Oh, yeah, that's me." You know what I mean? Like, I got all these ideas, but I can't get out of my own way, you know? And that's been a journey of learning about myself. And I can't do it. Like, I can't, like, check me out. I just haven't really been able to do that. So, like, I have the sponsors and the group and God that show me. You know, if I'm thinking I'm too much for myself, I'm usually put in my place pretty quick. And I think I'm done because I just right out. That's it. Thanks.
For somebody who thought she didn't have much to say, you had an awful lot to say, Patty, and I'm sure glad you're not on the ground reaching for my throat. You know, I started by saying that, you know, when I think of breaching the walls of the ego, you know, it reminds one of war and battles and that kind of thing, and that's just not what happens here. You heard it from Earl, you heard it from Patty. What a beautiful program that gives us the opportunity to do this thing in a way that's hard sometimes, demands a whole lot of us, but it's still a very gentle, loving approach. And I see Luke shaking his head, agreeing. Now, we have one speaker left, and many of you know who that man is. I know that he has lots to say on this subject, so with that, I introduce to you Lee from Florida.
Hi, everybody. My name is Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And it's an honor to be asked to participate at the International Convention and to be in Canada. I love Canada, and I love coming here. And I've been here several times in the last 3 years, and I just want to keep coming back. Every summer in Florida, I want to come to Canada. Mildred's one of my heroes, and anytime I'm with Mildred somewhere, I know I'm in the right place. I've got some other heroes here today, too. I see Tom there and Keith here on the front row. I'm sure there's others here, the men that have helped me, women. Through the years, I feel a little bit inferior standing here in front of some of these people trying to talk about something when I know they could do such a better job at it than I. Jean dressed me. I thank Jean. She bought me this tie. I love it. If they buy you gifts and you thank them in public, they get you more. I love the idea of meeting people from all over the world and stuff like that. Other members of Alcoholics Anonymous from all over the place. Scott and Kevin are here to live. We were all on a sober cruise a couple of years ago, and I learned that in Alaska, it is against the law to serve alcohol to a moose. I mean, they had to write a law. It was getting way out of hand. My sobriety date is November the 20th, 1984, and I want to thank you for that. And I'm a member of the Central Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet in downtown Orlando, right in the middle of the city. Some of our group members here, and it's the oldest group in the Orlando area. Our group started in April of 1945 when a guy by the name of David Andrews got a copy of this book, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, from a doctor that told him he couldn't help him. And David started implementing the suggestions in this book and started reaching out to other alcoholics. And as a result of that, he started maintaining sobriety. And because our group has been around so long, we have a lot of old-timers at our group. And we love our old-timers. I was at a meeting not long ago. I heard a brand-new guy stood up and said, "Last week I was in a hot tub naked with 5 naked women." Old-timer jumped up and said, "You'll never have to go through anything like that again." I don't know how you drank, but I'm going to tell you how I drank. And this is me. When I drink alcohol, I cannot control the amount of alcohol that I drink. Something happens to me. I develop an unquenchable thirst for alcohol. And I can no longer control it once I start. And for a long, 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 long time, I didn't want to control my drinking. I wanted to get drunk. And I got drunk. I got drunk, 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 drunk. And I love to drink alcohol. But the day came that I did not want to lose my job. I did not want to wreck my car. I did not want to hurt my family. I didn't want to have all the trouble I'd been having. And I said, "I'm not going to get drunk, 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 drunk tonight. I'm just going to get half drunk." And I couldn't get half drunk. I got all drunk. And I found out that I could not control the amount of alcohol that I drank once I put alcohol in my body. And that's a bad problem. When you love to drink the way I love to drink, and you can't drink without losing control, it's a terrible problem. But I've got another problem, and it's a whole lot worse than that problem. I've got a mental problem. I've got a problem with my mind. Because when I learned my lesson, when I said I was never going to do it again, no matter what, you know, I'm never going to have that problem again. I'm glad I'm over with that. I've made a decision. Everybody's happy. I've got a job. Things are going great. All of a sudden, I changed my mind. And having a drink of alcohol sounds like the best idea I've had in a long time, you know. And I'll go and have a drink of alcohol. And in no time at all, I'm in all the trouble that I was in just maybe a week before. And I'll tell you something else about this mental problem. There were times in my life when I could sit in front of a can of beer. And I said, "I'm not going to open this beer. I know what's going to happen. If I open this beer, I know that I'm going back to jail. I know it. And then I'll open it." So knowing and having it clear in my mind is not a defense against me taking that first drink. But I'm happy to announce that the day came. Things got so bad for me that I ended up in a room called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm happy to announce that after coming to you and following the suggestions in the pages of this book and getting a sponsor and getting involved in this thing that I have not changed my mind about a drink of alcohol in over 20 years. And that's a miracle. That's a miracle. And if you drank the way I drank, and if you could not leave it alone, no matter what, and that has happened for you, that's a miracle for you too. And we've got a great deal here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I took my first drink when I was about 15 years old. There was a little girl that lived in a neighborhood that I was nuts about. I lived with my grandparents. And I would peep through the window and watch as I would see her driving up in her car. She was 2 years older than me and was a cheerleader. And she'd get out of that car and run in the house, and I'd just look at her. Wow, boy, you know, and I love her. I want to be with her. I'm going to talk to her. But I could never go and talk with her. I could never make an... I'd see her at school. And I would just run out of the room if I saw her in the same room. There was never a time in my life that I didn't feel less than, inferior to, or fearful of, you know, other people. And, of course, our book describes that as being self-centered, a self-obsession. I had that from the very beginning. I didn't need alcohol to become self-centered. I was always that way. I needed alcohol to get out of that, and that's what happened to me. One day when a buddy of mine, my parents were gone, my grandparents, a buddy of mine came over to our home with two bottles of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. I drank one bottle, and he drank the other one. And in 10 minutes, I was standing out on the roof of my grandparents' house screaming out my declaration of love, you know, for this girl. I felt like I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof, omnipotent. And that's the way I always wanted to feel. Alcohol was working for me. And I just stood up there saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. You make the stars shine. You make the sun rise. She came outside. And her parents came outside, you know. And some of the other neighbors came outside, but I didn't care, you know. I just said, I love you, yes, you, yes, you, you know. She just buried her face in her hands like this. And I knew instantly that she wanted me. So alcohol was working, you know. And I made it a point to drink alcohol every opportunity I had after that. And, you know, immediately on the way to school, my buddies and I, we would pool our lunch money. You could get a case of Boone's Farm for $7.20. And we started drinking that on the way to school. It never bothered me from the beginning to drink in the mornings. You know, why wait until evening to feel so good? Within 3 weeks of my first drink, I can remember back today, and I can see myself sitting in the back seat of a buddy of mine's car at the dairy treat. They're all out talking to girls and being with people, and I'm in the back seat all by myself with three quarts of Budweiser, completely content. You know, I felt like I was surrounded with friends and people that loved me, you know. It never bothered me to drink alone from the very beginning. I can't explain that. But for me, adding alcohol to my body when I was about 15 years old was like taking a match and throwing it in a bucket of gasoline, just whoosh. And that's the way it was for me. It's not like that for all of us, but that's the way it was for me. And I began having trouble immediately. And I drank a lot. I loved it. I thought it was a compliment. People would come up to me and say, boy, you sure do drink a lot. And I'd say, oh, thank you, you know. But I immediately started laying out all night and upsetting. My parents had a lot of concern for me. But I was caught in the grip of an obsession greater than any human power could deliver me from. I had no idea. My family had no idea. We knew nothing about alcoholism. So I went the course that you go here in Alcoholics Anonymous, down. You know, we go down, 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 down. And I'm happy to announce I never lost anything because of alcoholism. Because of alcoholism, I never got anything, you know. I didn't get anywhere in life. I got my first prison bit. I'm a little anxious sitting here next to His Honor, you know. I don't think you ever quite get over that. But I got my first prison bit when I was 19 years old. I had a date that I was supposed to get out. I couldn't be good in prison either. And I ended up extending that stay. 2 months after I was out of that mess, I stood before the same judge, got a 20-year prison sentence. And when I was 30 years old, I wound up in Seminole County Jail in Central Florida. I moved all over the United States. You know, happiness is Arkansas in the rearview mirror. You know, God, I moved everywhere. And none of it worked, but it was in the Seminole County Jail that I was separated from alcohol. And I was just standing in the jail one night. You know, I'd been to a few meetings called Alcoholics Anonymous. It looked like a step down to me. But It was there in the Seminole County Jail. They had said, AA meeting. And I remember thinking, why would they have one of those here? You know? I'm standing here this morning because a man came to a jail. That's why I'm here. Jerry had never been in jail. Jerry was an AA member. Jerry was a war hero. He'd been to Vietnam. He was a citizen. He could vote. Jerry was a man that wanted to bring a meeting to men or women that could not go and get a meeting for themselves. And Jerry brought us a meeting. And he brought us books, copies of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was there that I heard Alcoholics Anonymous, listening to Jerry. And something happened to me. The miracle of identification took place. I began to see that perhaps this is my problem. Maybe this is what I need to do. And certainly it was. And I embraced Alcoholics Anonymous there in the Seminole County Jail and started trying to do the things that you guys suggested. And, you know, we're talking about ego today and overcoming ego, which is certainly a problem. You know, in my home group, I don't know about your home group, but we have big deals and big wheels. You know, I got a big home group, and we've got a guy, he's a big wheel and a big deal. And this seems to separate him from other people. And I can only assume that if I'm separated from other people, I must be separated from God on some level. And we have other people in our groups, in my group. They'll come in, and they always got their head down. And they'll, if you have a topic meeting, they'll say, I have a topic, let's talk about guilt. I'm so guilty. I feel worse about myself than anybody here. I feel so bad about myself, you know. We've got one guy whose ego seems to be very high and another person who seems to be very low. It's the same thing, you know. It doesn't matter if it's high or low. It separates us from the power that can keep us sober one day at a time. My sponsor calls it self-centeredness. I saw the perfect picture of the self-centeredness of the alcoholic one day while watching the Discovery Channel and the African dung beetle. What this little beetle does, he'll crawl up on a big, huge pile of dung. He'll stand on his front legs and with his back legs start rolling a little ball of it, and he will roll it and roll it and roll it. And when he gets so big that he cannot move it any longer, he crawls to the top of it, bores a little hole down into the middle of it, crawls down inside of that thing and lives there. I said, man, hey, man, that looks just like an alcoholic. You know? My whole life is crap, you know. I've always been that way. I've always been that way. My sponsor tells me that all my resentments result from not getting my will in the past, that all my anger and depression today result from not getting my will in the present, and that all my fear in my life today is my concern that I'm not going to get my will in the future. I've always been that way. Alcohol helped that. Alcohol helped me with that. But now I'm in a program of recovery, and I'm going to learn a different basis on which to live the rest of my life one day at a time, a whole new life. That's what you gave me. I was standing in a jail cell in November of 1984, and I walked into a meeting called Alcoholics Anonymous with the hope that maybe the judge would hear about it and cut me a little slack. You know, that was all that I saw that you might could offer me. And you gave me a whole brand new life. You gave me the whole thing. You didn't give me a piece of a life. You didn't give me a part of a life. You gave me a whole life, a whole existence. So I was faced with doing a four-step inventory. Let me tell you that. If you're new and you're concerned about this four-step, I can't face myself on paper. This is too much. I can't handle this. I'm too young. That list, that's not a list of who you are. That's a list of who you aren't. That's what we're going to get rid of. Five times in our text it says we're going to get rid of it. We're going to get rid of it. It blocks us off from this power. We're going to get rid of this, you know. You know, there is one who has all power. If you are separated from the one who has all power, that makes you powerless. That doesn't leave us much, you know. So now we're going to get rid of those things that block us off. You're in a hot air balloon, you want to go higher, what do? You get rid of something. You go higher. A statue of a woman, long flowing gown, beautiful statue. They asked the sculptor, how did you do that? He said, I got rid of what was ugly, and this is what was left. That's what we're going to do in this inventory process, in this house cleaning process. You know that feel? You know all that stuff we're writing down? That's not who you are. That's not who God made you to be. When God made you, He made you sweet and whole and clean. I've got a little 7-year-old daughter. 7 years old. I was holding my baby in my arms just the other day. And I looked at her, and I'm watching her, and I'm holding her, and she is pure and sweet and clean and whole, and she's complete, and she lacks nothing. That's how God made you. That's what you came here with. What we've done is gone out in this world in an effort to survive alcoholism and self-centeredness. And we picked up a lot of rotten, nasty, filthy stuff. Never who we were. Never who God intended us to be or what He intended for us. Now we have an opportunity to get rid of it, you know, and maintain that on a daily basis once and for all. Four times in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it guarantees us that there's a drink of alcohol in our for us. It guarantees us a drunk. If we fall short, if we fail to overcome resentment, if we continue to harbor resentment in our lives, the book says we will get drunk. In the sex inventory, it says that if we continue to harm others, continue to be selfish there, that we will get drunk. In our fifth step, it says newcomers try to hold on certain facts of their life, want to keep secrets to themselves, stuff they're not willing to share. Invariably, they got drunk. It guarantees us a drunk. It says they only thought they'd lost their egoism and fear. Egoism, that a life based on self, a life surrounded by me getting what I think I need to have for me rather than what taking care of you or having you in my life or in my thoughts. Success comes as a result of what we do for ourselves, but significance comes as a result of what we do for others. Make a living by what we get. We make a life by what we give. Riches to the world is who's gotten most, but riches to God is who has given most. There has to be a shift in our thinking in this area, and on a psychic level, psychic change. But I did a fifth step there in the Seminole County Jail. You know, I said, I'm going to do the fifth step. The guy said, you can't do the fifth step. You're in jail. You know, do the fifth step. Most of the worst stuff in my life was a matter of public record anyway. You could pick up the newspaper, read big portions of my fifth step. All my life, I've been two Lees. There was the Lee that everyone got to see, kind of like the book says, the actor. And then there was another Lee, secret Lee. Nobody got to see that Lee. Nobody. One night in Seminole County Jail, I went into a room with a man for 2 hours. When I came out, I walked out. I was one whole Lee for the first time in my life. One whole Lee. What a program. What an opportunity. What a gift. The book says that if we fail to perfect and enlarge our spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, we could not survive the certain, not uncertain, trials and low spots that are coming in each and every one of our lives. It says if we won't work, we'll drink. So we have to make progress in that area. We have to develop a life that we can share with others. And to let people into our lives in service in Alcoholics Anonymous, like Patty was talking about. We have to give ourselves to this thing. Now, when a guy calls me and says, Lee, I slipped. I drank. I said, no. What part of that program that I just described to you did you not implement thoroughly? What part of the program did you not practice into your life to the complete ability? What did you hold back on? Because when we do those things, the obsession to drink alcohol is lifted, and we can live one day at a time free. Let me tell you this. Think of this. One day at a time, freedom from hate. That's what we can have in the fourth step. One day at a time, freedom from fear. Today, freedom from fear. Today. What a gift. Sane and sound ideal for future sex life, right there in the fourth step. What a gift. We have so much. No more secrets. Freedom from old ideas. Freedom from guilt in 8 and 9. My God, what a program. Mildred hasn't written me a note, so I know I've got some time left. Let me tell you about my daughter. Hey, I told you where I came from. It says, boy, you got big arms. Meet me later. Let me tell you about my daughter. You know where I came from. 17 and a half years of my life in the correction system. Let me tell you this. After my sobriety, the greatest blessing that I have in my life today is my little 7-year-old daughter, Hannah. Now you tell me, what will God withhold? If I can have something that wonderful, what would God withhold from any of us? God has good things for us. wonderful things for us. Let's just get busy with this recovery program so that we can open this channel up and we can receive these great things that God has for each and every one of us. I went just before she had her fourth birthday, we were driving down the street and I had 10 soft cover big books in the back seat. She was in her little baby seat and she leaned over. She said, "Daddy, read me this Bible." I said, "Well, open it up, you know." And she knew her numbers, and she opened the big book up. Page one. "One, Daddy, read me one." I said, "One, that's Bill's story." On page one of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that God cares about alcoholics. Boy, she laughed. She thought that was funny. She said, "Daddy, read me two. Read page two." I said, on page two of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that God cares about alcoholics. She laughed. She said, "Read me three. Read me three." I said, "Well, on page three of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that God cares about alcoholics." I said, "You read me four." She looked down, looked back up. She said, "Says God cares." I said, "Read me five." She said, "It says God cares." I said, "Turn the page and read six." She said, "It says God cares." And by the time we got to Chick-fil-A, my little baby had read half the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a book. We have a way out. Each and every page, every paragraph, every line, every sentence, it says God cares, God cares, God cares. And He cares about us. And He cares about our illness. And He's constantly telling us that. Each and every meeting we go to, we sit there and just listen to that over and over and over and over again. My little daughter, she'll play a game. You've seen this before. Okay. It doesn't say you've got big arms this time. Let me close with this real quick, guys. I had a lot of trouble with this higher power thing. For you that might be struggling with that, I'm going to close with a story. It's a true story. It happened in Armenia in 1989. A father walked his son to school one morning. And he got to the steps of the school. He left his son there and walked several blocks to where he was working. That day in Armenia, they had an earthquake. They don't build buildings in Armenia the way they build them out in California. They build them out of rock and stone and brick, and that city was destroyed. The father miraculously drug himself out of the building he was in and ran those blocks where that school had been, past fires, emergency vehicles, people screaming. Got to the steps of the school. It was just a pile of stone. And he ran to the top of the pile and started throwing bricks and throwing rocks and screaming out his son's name, "Armand, Armand, Armand." And people would come to him and say, "Let me help you. You're bleeding. We'll bandage you." And he'd say, "Help me find my son. Help me find my son." And they'd say, "We can't help him. He's delirious." And they'd go help somebody else. 36 hours later, he was still there throwing rocks and throwing bricks and screaming out his son's name. After 36 hours, he heard something. He said, "Armand, is it you?" He heard, "Yes, Father, it's me." He said, "Son, are you all right?" He heard, "Yes, Father, I'm all right. There are 13 of us in here. I told them that if my father is alive, he will not rest until he helps me, until he saves me. And after he helps me, he'll help you too. You new people, I've got real good news. Here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a father." In the fifth chapter, Bill Wilson wrote, "He is the father. We are his children." In the closing of Dr. Bob's story, Dr. Bob wrote, "Your heavenly father will never let you down." Here in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you have a heavenly spiritual father who will not rest until he saves you. He will not rest until he reaches you. And after he helps you, he's going to use you to help somebody else. I love you and thank you for helping me so today.
That. I think we've had a very fine panel. And we heard three very different, kind of the same, but very different interpretations of how people have come from an ego-based life to a God-based life. And I'll leave it at that. And I know that some of you are planning to go to other meetings, so we'll bring this meeting to a close. And it is my choice to either close it with the Lord's Prayer, the Serenity Prayer, or the Responsibility Declaration. And out of no disrespect to anybody else's belief, but it's customary in Toronto that we close with the Lord's Prayer. So for those who will you help me close this meeting with the Lord's Prayer? Our Father,
thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us